Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now, I told you we'd introduce you to our esteemed business review panel. They're here in the shape of Ronan Reid of Cantor Fitzgerald and Susan Hayes-Culleton, my colleague here at the station and the presenter of Taking Stock, which you can hear tomorrow morning. Now, welcome one and all. Ronan, I'll start with you. Let's look at the stock market, because it does tell us a lot. Stocks fall, oil prices rocket, all due to the Iranian war.
Yep, both stocks fell and indeed bond prices fell as well. I think it's Iranian war, but also even before that had happened, they'd begun to wobble a little bit. So much money was spent on AI and we began to see some little cracks within it. And on Friday, it wasn't just the Iranian war, it was also US payroll numbers were down. They were down 92,000. So generally, when stocks fall and bonds fall and prices are rising, people worry about stagflation. So no growth in inflation, and that's bad for asset classes. But I think the other side of it as well is the Iranian war impact is Middle Eastern sovereign funds are some of the biggest investors in the world.
Right.
So they will have to spend money on armaments and other things like that. The world has changed quite
a
bit.
So their spend gets diverted.
Yeah, or what they actually do is they pull investment out of some of the markets. They would be really significant sovereign Aramco or PIMCO or PIF fund, the Saudi PIF fund, any of the bigger sovereign funds are significant investors, and you've begun to see in credit markets funds coming out. So I think this will play out for a while yet.
Well, tell me about this VIX index, known as the fear gauge.
Yeah, it measures volatility. So what's volatile? How does it measure volatility? If people want to hedge markets and buy an option, so buy the right to sell something or the right to buy something. If you think it's going up, you buy a call. It's the right to buy something in the future. If you want to sell it, it's a put option. The key component that determines that pricing is volatility, the expected volatility. It's arrived at, it's nearly calculated out, but people started measuring it about 15 years ago as a measure of where volatility was. For a long time, and particularly in low interest rates, that it was the lowest it had ever been. It was 10 or 12%. It can move anywhere up to 35%, between 20 and 35%. It has been relatively, it tends to be an after the event as much as before the event. It rises in the expectation, but it hasn't always. I mean, the stellar thing that has risen over time over the last 2 years has been gold and gold prices on fear of global issues and global turmoil. And that has continued over time as well.
You know all about the VIX gauge, Susan, do you?
I do, indeed. And insofar as one can, because it's a fear gauge more so than anything else. Now, the level at which it's currently at is at 28, which is elevated. It's very elevated. Anything above 30 means that you're looking at extreme fear. And given the fact that we've seen oil prices rise more in the past week than it did at the start of the invasion of Ukraine, etc., it just shows how much the market is very concerned. But of course, like what people have stopped talking about this week is the global tariff, which we were all talking about the week before.
How quickly we forget.
And also as well, remember that Trump seems to be getting a real taste for this military intervention carry on. So therefore, he's now said that he's looking for potentially to do the same in Cuba. He's also now, I mean, as we're looking here at the breaking news that's happening this morning, they're talking about like the biggest intervention is yet to happen. And so they're talking about like a war lasting about 5 to 6 weeks. But I don't know whether one can think that it will be that quick, given the fact that war and interventions like what's happening at the moment, there are so much outside of the control of one decision maker. It might have been his decision with Israel to go in, but I don't think it's going to be as simple as that to come out.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a famous case when you look back to the Roman Empire of when they were really stretched, and what they did was they'd take in 10 coins, gold coins, and they'd shave them, and they'd produce 11 coins. That's what you do. They've devalue the dollar in some way, they will have to do it. All of this military spend has to be funded, and it's absolutely astronomical at a time when the US budget deficit was already well into its trillions and problematic. So,
and then there's probably going to be inflationary pressures at home that are going to bring on real political pressure.
Well, I'd say, like, domestically, the big issue in the State of the Union address that he was quite scathing of mentioning was affordability. He said that the Democrats have just come up with that as a concept. But if you talk to people on the ground in America, it's far from just a concept. I mean, when you see at the moment that oil is at $91 a barrel, and many of the investment community are predicting that that will be over $100 by the end of next week, if things continue the way they are, that will very, very quickly pass on. If you remember as well, during the State of the Union, he was talking about $1.99 a litre of gas. There was only 8 stations in America that had that price. Today, it's zero.
Wow. Yeah, and the other side is, if part of your solution is to devalue the dollar went from 103 to 119, you end up importing inflation. That's what happens. And that has been a periodic worry in the bond market. So US bond yields previously, when it was up, hit about 4.5%. And you'll often look at US bond yields and the VIX index itself. When you bring it back to the VIX, it's really about what's the cost of insurance, like, you know, and that's going up essentially.
Let's talk about fuel prices, because the fuel giants are using the war to fleece. There's been a lot of debate around this over the past week. Susan, we see Mr. McPartlin getting quizzed. We see the government getting involved, and we see a kind of a sort of a phony war almost around what's actually happening and who's gouging, if gouging is the right term. But it looks like that the politicians have brought in the old review by the Competition Authority to kind of take the heat out of this and say we're doing something. But really, is there an argument that says the consumer has been ripped off because the petrol in the tank didn't cost the fuel retailer what he's now increased it by?
And that's the subject of the review, which some of the journalists that we're referring to here today have said it's buying time. Let's set this in context, first of all. We're spending €1 million an hour on fossil fuels in the country. And I heard that figure 10 days ago, which means that now, if you were to take that into consideration of the changes, that number would have considerably gone up. And also, the state takes 60% of the price of a litre at the pump.
So they're a beneficiary in any rise.
Oh, they would be.
They would be, yeah. Say it's 60% of a bigger number.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think that the government is trying to sit down and work out how to maximise the amount that they can take off the taxpayer. But certainly, I mean, it would have been a feature of Pascal Donoghue's design of his budgets over the year is to increase carbon taxes so as to disincentivize the use of fossil fuels and incentivize green energy. However, that's looking into the future. What's going on here is that the way in which prices are supposed to be designed is according to the wholesale market, not the raw energy price itself. So when I was referring earlier to the fact that the price of oil has gone up to $91 a barrel, that's Brent, that's up 25% in the week. What the petrol pump should be is related to what's going on in the wholesale market, and that has gone up 35%.
We're using the wrong benchmark by judging the price of Brent crude, and it's up, or its rise relative to the cost of buying in the European fuel.
Exactly, by actually buying in the input itself.
Yeah.
However, we go back to your point, though, is that the petrol that one might put in their car on Wednesday of this week was probably imported before the 28th.
It's hard to shake that argument
and
off.
And that's the argument.
Yeah.
It is. It's certainly not defending them, but if I was running that business, I'd be saying today, how's price going to move in the next couple of months? Get the price up now, build some capacity, because my business may not have the same supply or other levels. But the issue for me comes back to far more fundamental. I think in Cliff Taylor's article, he said there was a task force set up to say, why are energy prices higher here in Ireland? And they've met only twice in a year and a bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this seems so reactionary. I mean, a competition review doesn't say, hey, are you gouging? It says, are you colluding? And that's a big difference.
Yeah, you're entitled to charge what you want.
You're entitled to charge what you want. But the problem is the structure. I think in the article I saw the reference to setting up the liquefied national gas terminals that would give us at least 30 days supply. The idea being that you can buffer out some of the changes. But also the debate in terms of deep offshore wind, how slow it's been. It's like they're saying it's 2033 before that comes into play. We were touching on nuclear as an option that needs. We're an island and the world's in war and trade wars. We need to create a defensive means to power our island. And it just doesn't seem, it seems to get occasional comment when we've got a problem, but there doesn't seem to be a plan.
Yeah. Susan, some reports in the Mail today telling us of abuse around fuel forecourt staff. This seems like a kind of a really horrendous thing to happen to somebody who's in the front line of charging for petrol or home heating oil.
Now, I can understand people's frustration with driving past a petrol pump and saying, God, the price of that now is a lot higher than yesterday or the day before. But there's no point in taking it out on the person who's taking the money for it. I mean, they're not setting the price. The point here that Peter Burke is making is that he said, after meeting with Fuels for Ireland and industry stakeholders to discuss the jump in oil price in recent days and a result of the Israel war on Iran, a consequence of that is that people are taking out their frustration on people in retailers. And I mean, it's just not acceptable for people to go in and take out their frustration there. Now, of course, the thing is of course, one can understand the price of carting a family around or the price of anybody who's involved in haulage, etc. It is frustrating. But that is, of course, a real challenge. Going back to the point that Rona there was making about Cliff Taylor's piece is, I was surprised actually that Cliff didn't look more so at what's happening on an onshore basis. If you look at a county like Offaly, ironically actually, Offaly, despite the fact that it's landlocked, it's the Switzerland of the country, one could say, so it can get involved in offshore, but it actually is the highest generator of renewable. There's
I'm just trying to get that image of Switzerland and Offaly in my head.
Well, while you're settling into that now, it is responsible for 2.3% of the landmass of the country, and yet is the greatest renewable energy generator in the country at the same time. And when I was looking at what it's been doing recently, like, it is now developing battery storage. There was a 4-hour battery storage launch there a couple of weeks ago. It is doing remarkable heavy lifting in the context of the whole country. And so I think we're actually making more progress on this than we're appreciating at the moment. So we need to take not just the delay in offshore, but actually what is happening on onshore. All that said, though, that is of scant help to somebody today who is looking to fill up their SUV, let's say, this afternoon. And that's the challenge with not moving fast enough with green energy developments, is because when we need it, just as Ronan said, we are an island. The focus on energy security and indeed defence security, we have taken our eye off that ball. And something like what's happening this week just shows how important this is.
Yeah, I think. And all the articles naturally focused on the consumer. But I also think about infrastructure. I chair school, or if you look at hospitals, they're all old buildings.
Yeah.
The impact of higher energy prices into their operation is really significant. Like, it can suddenly ramp up and eat into investment in the school. I think that's part of what the state is, again, the structure, looking at task force. How do you reduce that demand? How do you incentivize move again to other fuels and look at the structure that sits around it? But my point is back is, like, you have a task force. Like, it costs more to build roads here in Ireland. Energy costs more. Why is that? You set up a task force and they don't even meet. Like, they meet twice a year and you're going, why? Yeah.
Yeah, no. And I think the CCPC investigation is a buying of time.
It's a soundbite.
But what Cliff says here, and when you read it first, it sounds awful, but he says there is no legal obligation on companies to set their prices at a level that consumers consider fair.
Yeah.
They're private companies, though. And this is the thing, is that if the country would be overly regulated, there would be nobody set up a business here at all. That said, it is a huge input into so many families inputs, and therefore the CCPC, he says, Cliff Taylor says, they can do two things: look for evidence of collusion and also look, as I was saying, at the trend of wholesale prices to make sure that what they are saying they're doing is actually happening. And that part is important, but we have to understand the difference between what someone like the CCPC can do and what we would want them to do.
Evidence of collusion, very, very hard to prove.
Yeah,
investigate even.
Yeah, and investigate or prove. But some of the time when they say it's private companies as well, banks, and we'll get on to bankers' pay later, but banks did bad things and they got taxed on certain types of their profits. And like, you do have a state. Like, you don't want to overregulate, but you can intervene in certain circumstances for periods of time when exceptional things are happening. But we just don't seem to have a plan.
Well, there's also a little bit of conflicting evidence as well in the various different pieces this morning about what the government is actually planning to do. On one hand, they're saying they're not going to rule out supporting some sort of support in energy prices. And on the other hand, then they're also saying, well, they don't want to go down the road of the energy credits like they did before.
Where people were getting reimbursements that they didn't need.
And Cliff Taylor highlighted that half of households didn't need those. And I mean, that's when you think about, let's say, the things that we were discussing last year, like the 600 million for the hospitality sector, etc. So what's not clear and where time is being bought is what can the government do to support households? And remember, I know this has only happened a week ago. One could argue that you could see the signs coming, but it's not like the government departments have nothing to do.
But we also came through COVID and other infrastructure damages before, where pipelines, we've had Russia threaten stuff before. We've had this. We had this at the start of the Ukrainian war, and we don't see. I mean, I'm sure there'll be some very funny skit coming up on radio of everybody sitting around saying, what do? We say we're looking at the competition authority and chuck it out. Like, have a plan.
I think the other thing to remember is that the budget is coming in October, as is the winter. So if the fuel prices are really high... at budget time, which is looking like they might be, it's going to be a very difficult time politically for the government.
But this is the point about saying that this is a 4 or 5 week war. I mean, that might have worked in Iran the last time that Trump went in to take out the nuclear facility. He was emboldened by going into Venezuela and taking Maduro out. This is different. And this war is expanding right across the Middle East. So like even if he was to say, you know what, I'm out of here, and he leaves Iran, that's the way in which that region is now in a very different state than it was 2 weeks ago.
Susan, when I have you there, some good news here from the Irish Times, reporting by Owen Burke Kennedy. The number of women in employment in Ireland has jumped 82% since 2000. It's a great statistic.
It is.
And I know there are, we often hear debate about, you know, women's participation in the workplace, but I just wanted to highlight this because it's a great stat to herald.
So first of all, happy International Women's Day to you both.
Thank you.
For tomorrow.
Thank you, Susan.
And indeed to all of your listeners. Yes, indeed. The fact that women in employment have jumped by 82% is really striking. There was 1.3 million women in employment in the final quarter. And by the way, that is in the context, because there was a report out this week as well, that we now have 2.83 million people in total employment in the country. So 1.3 million women, about 1.5 million men. There, I just want to set the context of this, of course, Bobby, too, that the population has increased by more than 100,000 every year for the past 4 years. So that we're not quite comparing apples to apples. That said, though, there is a couple of really striking things in this piece. Number one is that there has been, as one would expect, a dramatic fall in the number of people, not percentage, number of people who now say that they're engaged in home duties as their full-time status. That number was 520,000, 2010. That's now down to just under
100,000. So that tells us that there's more...
fewer women staying at home.
Well, but double-income families, where two people are having to go out to work, where in the past maybe only... you know, only one carried the burden.
And birth rates are declining. Like, it just wasn't feasible. Like if you had three children, it becomes really challenging, and birth rates have fallen. But to your point, Susan, absolutely correct. You'd love to see the percentage of the population, not the percentage increase.
And when we talk about prices of houses, which for once we're not doing this time, this has been the first time in about 2 years we've talked about that. But what I will say, though, is the double income, of course, has had a particularly disproportionate impact on the price of houses. But also this does question, to your point there, Ronan, about there would be a lower possibility now for one parent, female or otherwise, most likely female, we know based on the statistics, to stay at home. But when we look at what women are earning, there is, of course, a reference to the fact that the gender pay gap is 23%. I'm always just hesitant, though, to talk about that in that raw format, because that doesn't question what the work is.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, I think just putting out a raw number like that and not analysing it, of which I'm doing, but I just want to reference the fact that it's in there. But what is very welcome is the proportion of women among the top 1% of earners has increased by 5 percentage points to 27%. And of the percentage of women in employment with earnings in the top 10%, that's risen to 30%. So
in
summary,
one in three.
That's right.
Still a way to go, but it's one in three in the top 1%,
and
or in
Well, it's slightly lower in the top 1% and almost that in the top 10%. But what it's saying is there's more women in the workplace. It's saying there is more women earning more in the workplace. And also remember, we have to contextualise all of this, that still women still do 75% of the unpaid work in the world. So, like, obviously a shout out to the women in anyway, the fact that it's International Women's Day or otherwise, but there's an awful lot of women balancing an awful lot here. And I think they deserve a shout out on this.
As someone who lives in a house full of women, I'm absolutely with you, Susan. Now, Ronan, I know you're bursting to talk about bankers' pay. Joe Brennan has an interesting piece here about banker bonus caps growing more absurd.
Yeah, growing more absurd. But just before we started, like, the other side that's disappointing is the amount of female CEOs that have diminished in Ireland in large companies. That's an interesting, like, when 3 or 4 years ago, there were several, there are much less. We're looking at bankers. You don't see many women's names among them, which is interesting at the moment.
Yeah.
We've seen a move backwards. Don't know why it is. It might be just circumstance, but it hasn't been. But bankers' pay, I mean, it got legislated very heavily around the time of the crash where bonuses were cut back quite heavily. Then under part of the rules, and I think it spread from the UK, there was the right to give certain types of top-ups that had that were deemed allowances, but then turned out to be another form of variable pay.
This was 100% or 200%.
Yeah, that was the limit on the remuneration that needed to be there. And then thereafter, you had fixed allowances were allowed in banks. And then they said they were too variable, so it was cut back. So essentially what you ended up with was share-based incentives over time, but that have no variable. They're just given at the time. They're not linked as much to performance. And I think Joe's point is we're moving to a new era where caps have been lifted, so bonuses should be linked to performance, but shouldn't incentivize the type of performance that led to issues in the past. So, and I think it's common sense, have multi-year structures that do look back. So if something arises, it cuts back over time, but they probably need to simplify it. And I think in Ireland, we've lost a lot of banks here. We've lost the part that I would cover more in the article is perhaps the fact that going from 6 or 7 banks, we've gone down effectively to 3.
Yeah.
Perhaps a fourth to come in, which doesn't give great. It's great seeing the credit union movement coming through a lot more, and you can see them referenced on a number of areas. But basically, we need more competition on the banking
side. I think also inherently we don't like seeing bankers getting paid too much.
Isn't that right, Ronan?
Yeah, I think we don't like seeing anyone get paid too much. We're Irish.
But the,
like
also,
the poor, I couldn't
like
get
also,
over the...
AIB made over €1 billion.
Well, they made €2 billion. Bank made about €1.5 billion. And the entities, the state recovered a lot of the monies out of it over time. So once they had sold the shares, they couldn't influence as much. And a company does need to get on running. But you simply... If you have that concern that there is poor behaviour, you just elongate the period of the award. You have it looking back over time. In my industry, it now runs much longer. It runs 6 to 8 years. I'm not a banker. I'm a stockbroker. There is a difference. But I think the main thing they need to do is make it easier to transact. It has been disappointing that only one or two names has come up with PTSB.
Okay.
We want competitive banks, because the rates at which money is lent will become better for the consumer. And also banks have become conservative, very conservative.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've time for one more story. Let's do the stellar rating of a beloved Dublin cinema, Susan. I go every Christmas to watch Die Hard in the Stella Cinema in Rathmines. Mm. And it's one of life's great experiences.
Oh, it's a gorgeous place. And the Stella Cinema in Dublin has now been named one of the best in the world, beating cult Tokyo theatres, grand Parisian film temples, beloved Sydney picture houses and iconic cinemas in New York. It just shows it. I've been to Stella. Now, I don't have an annual tradition like your good self there, Bobby, but it is gorgeous. And it does kind of feel like you're back in the 1920s before everything went wrong with the financial crash and everything. And it is just the most luxurious place. It's a lovely, lovely
Let me read you a line. line from this because I think it's great. The Stella offers a heady mix of past and present, a luxurious time capsule back to the cinema gate going days of gone by, kitted out with all the latest in creature comforts and a cocktail bar straight out of the Great Gatsby. It's genuinely a dreamy place.
Like, well, fair play to Helen Bruce for writing that.
But, it is, but it's at Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Last Tycoon. And there's a great scene where he takes a silver dollar and flips it. And he says, in the cinema, for that, I bring you to another world.
If only listeners could see you actually act that out in front of us there, Ronan, because Bobby and I are looking at this.
All right, folks, that's all we got time for. A huge thanks to our business review panel, Susan Hayes-Cullerton and Ronan Reid.
Down to business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.